Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care. Welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim.
And I am Kara, a.k.a. the grumpiest cat.
Kara and I have been sitting here talking for a while, and I just decided we're going to go ahead and record this because Kara has opinions, and she needs to
share them with the world. Listen, I mean, I think people are very, very quick when you are a woman, especially if you are a pregnant woman, to be like, oh, you're just pregnant, you're hormonal. Oh, is it your period? And it's like, no, I just have freaking opinions. And for me, I am an Enneagram 9. So we've talked about this a little bit in the past, but Enneagram 9s kind of strive to be the peacemaker. They can very often be the person who's like, oh, well, we can do whatever it is that everyone else wants to do. And historically, that was me. But I find the more that I heal, the less I am like that. And it means that I have a lot of opinions, which I always have had opinions. I just have never, I guess, necessarily put my foot down, and we're building a house. And so it's becoming apparent to me even more so that when we as women have opinions, it often is a point of negotiation when you are in a conversation with men. It's not as if a man would say, okay, this is exactly the appliance I want. This is the price point that I have. This is what's important to me. And that would be it in a conversation with a man. But for me, for women in general, it's, you know, the beginning of a negotiation. And it's just, I got opinions and I just need them to be respected. God, it's driving me crazy.
It's kind of the scenario that you're in here. It's almost as if you are being patted on the head. Mm-hmm. There, little woman.
Yeah.
We know better. And the phrase that I said when she was going through this with the appliances and such was, don't bring me a dead cat if you aren't bringing me a shovel at the same time. Dude, which I now realize a lot of people take issue with that phrase, but it's, don't bring me a problem if you aren't also bringing me a solution.
Right. And I thought it was funny that you said that because I started telling you what I'm going through. And without any more context, I was like, that's exactly what's happening. It's not my builder. My builder is fantastic. It is someone that he sources appliances specifically as the issue. This will not be the last time during the building process, I'm sure, that this will happen to me. But this is the reason why I have an assistant. This is the reason why my husband and I have an agreed upon rule, which is if there's something that I do or do not want or want to do, I can blame it on him so that I'm not the bad guy. because I can come to someone and say, this is exactly what I want. And they're like, well, that's a bad decision. And here's why that's a bad decision. When I have literally spent weeks researching what it is that I want. And then they say, oh, well, that's a terrible decision. And that's it. I'm like, okay, well, if it's such a terrible decision, give me something better. Give me what you have that's better. Tell me why. I'm really not unreasonable. I can see all perspectives. So if you come to me and you say, okay, so which this is what my builder does. He says, okay, you said that you wanted this. That's not what we usually do. Here's what we usually do. And here's why it will work for you. And here's why it's better. And that's fine. I respect that. I need that. And when someone comes to me with the cat and the shovel, and they're like, that's a problem, but here's the better answer. Perfect. Let's go with that. But when you come to me and you're like, well, that's a dumb decision. Just screw yourself. I mean, in the nicest way. I mean that in the nicest way. Bless your heart is the Southern way.
With all due respect, go F yourself.
I mean, right. And like, yes, I am fiery. And this was my pet peeve in both my previous pregnancies as well, is something that is my natural inclination. Somebody's like, you're just emotional because you're pregnant. It's like, no, I am actually being my true self. It has nothing to do with being pregnant. The crux of it for me is, yes, I am pregnant. And so I have less time and I have less tolerance for your BS. It's not that I'm hormonal or it's making me unreasonable. It's like, I got a lot of stuff to do. Like, don't come at me with this noise. maybe it is pregnancy that's giving me less patience, so to speak, or, you know, it's the fact that I'm healing, so I feel okay. I feel confident enough to speak up with my opinions, but has nothing to do with me being a woman or being hormonal or being bitchy, because a woman who is straightforward about what she demands, what she needs, what her standards are, is a bitch, right? And it's like, or she's hormonal or whatever. And it's like, no, I have opinions. I feel confident enough to state what my opinions are, and I expect them to be respected. And if you don't agree with my opinions, please bring me the cat and the shovel, and that's fine. We'll have a conversation. I'm up in arms, guys.
I'm over here just... But I like that you didn't say, you aren't presenting pregnancy or healing or anything else as an excuse for voicing what you do and do not want, what your boundaries are, what your... Look, at the end of the day, it is your money that you are spending. And if somebody is going to treat you that way, you can take your business elsewhere. Because quite frankly, we don't have the time, we don't have the tolerance to be treated like that anymore. And if we don't do it, what about the ones who maybe haven't found their voice yet? What are they supposed to do? And I understand and empathize with where you are at right now, especially in this home building process, because it is a freaking nightmare. Like, yeah. What a privilege, right? To be able to do this. And at the same time, there is this infrastructure within that amazing privilege that still has just the hooks and claws that maybe other people won't see yet, but it's some bullshit. And kudos to you for standing up for yourself.
I feel like it's the crux too of like the human existence as a woman and like being a survivor and why we're here doing this. Because you said, what about the other people who don't have their voice and they're going to get steamrolled? And it's like, that's why we do this. We do this because Kim and I have been through the gamut of stuff, and we have the experience and we have the confidence to say, no, you're not going to treat survivors like this. No, you're not going to speak to people like this. No, this is how you do ethical true crime. Like, we have the healing and the perspective to do this because there are so many people who can't. We're here standing up for survivors, for other people, because we don't care. Like, come at us, because we're ready. Like, we're ready to debate. We have opinions. We're grounded in what our beliefs and our confidences are. So like, we're just not as easily shakable. And so, you know, who would I be if I was not practicing what I preach in all arenas of life? You know, if I wasn't standing up for myself in the home building process and being just like fiery as heck. And when I say fiery, it really is mostly internally, because I like, as I am sitting here and talking about all of it, or as I was like talking to Kim and I was like, screw these people. Blah, blah, blah. Then I read out the email as I was typing it, and she was like, you're so professional. And I was like, well, yeah, obviously. Like, I'm very PC when I respond to people. I'm just going to internally bitch a lot before I do the thing that I'm supposed to do.
Piss and moan. Well, and I woke up, because again, 2 hour time difference here, I woke up to this string of texts about, this is bullshit, I don't want to do this, and I'm like, oh man, just let her go, give it a few, by the time that I talk to you, you'll have it worked out. Surely enough.
Yeah,
you have to process. You have your safe people to process with.
Yeah. And I think it makes me laugh, because it comes down to like what a lot of women who have significant others who are males have this issue with their significant others, which is, sometimes I need to complain about it. Sometimes I don't need a solution. And it depends on who I'm talking to, right? There's this story that I think most people have heard of the woman who is like, my head hurts really bad. It hurts. And her husband's like, well... And she's like, no, you're not listening. My head hurts. And it just goes on and on and on. And then eventually he's like, you have a nail in your forehead. And he's been trying to like give her the solution, but she just wanted to complain. So I think of that often. And I've had that, you know, had the conversation this morning with my husband about the appliances and the home building. And of course, he keeps giving me all these solutions. And I'm like, no, your job right now is just to listen to me, bitch. Like, I actually just need to complain to you for a minute and then I'll take care of it. But yeah, it's just an exercise in futility and growth at the same time.
It kind of reminds me, I put this on my story. It's a quote and it just says something like, if I owe you an email, imagine what I owe myself. And like, how is that for feeling overwhelmed by all of the things? Yes, I know. I need to get back to you. I have this thing. There's a million other things on top of that that I owe myself that I'm probably putting last.
Oh, yes.
And it is stuck in my brain so, so squarely. This on the heels of taking what was supposed to be 4 days, and we spontaneously decided to make 5. Mike and I went up to Estes Park to our family's cabin and stayed there. And our kids were off gallivanting across the country with grandparents, and it was phenomenal. So it was just us and the dogs shut off from normal world because we didn't really have service. And I needed that reset on the heels of just having gone through the parole process last Wednesday. Kara and I had talked about this, about whether or not to include this in the beginning, and I don't want to detract from our wonderful guest Julie's story. So stay tuned. We will be releasing just a quick bonus episode that I can update everyone and talk about this, because there are a lot of things that I haven't fully processed and been able to talk with you about that I still feel as though I need to get off my chest, because this one took me out for a while. But I didn't want to detract from Julie's story, and she is a wonderful survivor that Kara brought my attention to.
Yeah, I met Julie through Elizabeth Smart and through Maloof. And one thing that always strikes me about Julie is she is very calming and full of grace, and just she presents as put together to me. Yeah. Like when you see her, she's wearing like garden dresses, and she's beautiful. She's well-spoken.
Yeah, she's soft-hearted still.
Yes, she's soft-hearted and soft-spoken, which you will recognize in the interview. And it's interesting that she maintains that. And I think it's interesting when you consider how all of these things play together with her story. So a little bit about Julie. Julie is a survivor of 31 years of abuse, including childhood sexual abuse, domestic violence, and sex trafficking. She was raised in Bountiful, Utah, and her cycle of abuse began at the age of 4, continuing through her early teens and into her first marriage.
Despite years of trauma, Julie is recovering and finds hope in the future with her husband and 6 children. Today, she's an advocate for survivors of abuse and sex trafficking and inspires others with her remarkable courage. She's also an active speaker who focuses on bringing victims out of the shadows.
Julie serves on an advisory board for the Maloof Foundation and consults on a variety of initiatives, including On Watch, a free digital training that raises community awareness of sex trafficking in the United States.
Julie recently published her memoir and first book, Shadowed: How I Became the Sex Trafficked Mother Next Door. We do want to give you a heads up that this episode does include graphic depictions of sexual assault and suicidal ideation.
Here's our conversation with Julie. On today's podcast, we have Julie Whitehead. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. I'm so excited to have you here today. I've heard a little bit about your story. I've not read your book yet, but Kim is new to your story. Many of our listeners will probably be new to your story. We met about a year ago at the summit. I just knew when I saw your book came out that we had to have you as a guest. So I'm excited for everyone here to hear your story.
Thank you.
So one of the things that we always start the podcast off with, just as a little bit of an icebreaker, is that we want to know what your current binge is, whether it's TV shows or maybe a series of movies, books, podcasts, whatever it is. What's your current binge that you just can't get enough of?
I've been reading a book called The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls. I have to like keep myself limited to a certain time at night that I can read it, because I think I could read the whole thing in one sitting. So good. So yeah, I've been reading that.
I feel like I've heard of that.
I know. I was going to say that one's about, is it childhood abuse?
Yeah, it's neglect, kind of how these kids came through this crazy situation with their parents who didn't really provide for them or protect them. And they came through kind of all on their own and made successful lives for themselves. So I think it's just fascinating.
It's been in my orbit for forever and I haven't got to read it yet. But yeah, I may have to take the plunge after this now.
Definitely recommend it.
Yeah. Kim and I talk a lot about how we often will binge kind of mindless things because we're in this world. So it's always interesting to ask our guests, because we get such a variety of answers from people who are like, yeah, I watch, you know, dumb reality TV, to people that read books like The Glass Castle. And it's so interesting to hear what everyone is binging currently. So thanks for sharing that with us.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we do is we always ask our guests to share their story of how they became a survivor, what led them to be on the podcast, to their comfort level. So we would love for you to just kick off by sharing your story with us.
Okay. I always struggle because where to start. My story kind of one thing led into another. And I know you know how the cycle of revictimization works, and one circumstance made me vulnerable for the next. And so it's kind of just this big, long 31-year history. So I'll start at the beginning. I was abused by my father as a child, and that went into my early teen years. I was looking for someone to kind of rescue me from that situation and found a boyfriend whom, if I would have been healthier and had better experiences, I would have seen that he was not healthy himself and that he was actually dangerous and abusive. But I didn't see that. So I went into this relationship, stayed with him for 12 years. We married, we had 3 children. That was a really unhealthy relationship. I became very depressed, thought about taking my own life, and actually had a couple of attempts and needed some way to distract myself away from that abusive situation. And so I decided to get a job teaching preschool. It was great. It was like my saving grace. I loved being around the kids. They were amazing. And it kept me away from the house, me and the kids, because my kids were able to go with me. So we stayed there all day into late into the night. And unfortunately, that's where my trafficker comes in. He was a father of one of my preschool students. My marriage was ending badly. He was arrested for domestic violence. And the father of one of my preschool students contacted me and said, I just have this gut feeling that something's wrong with you, that you're going through a hard time, and I'd like to be there for you. So I didn't have a support system, so I relied really heavily upon him for about 2 weeks. He was kind of everything I needed him to be. He filled in all the gaps and encouraged me with my legal problems that I was going through with the divorce and the custody. And then he just completely changed. He raped me and became controlling and abusive and insisted that I take trips with him, which at first I didn't know obviously what that meant. But it turned out that he would take me on these trips to various locations, different states, even across the Mexico border, and he would traffic me. And I had no words for what was happening to me. I told him, why are you sharing me? And he would laugh to my face and say, yeah, I'm sharing you. But I just didn't know what else it was. I was really naive about that. So he trafficked me for 5 months. And then it was his employer. He made me meet with him to try to negotiate the purchase of a truck. And his employer just really saw through the whole charade and asked me what was really going on and if I was okay. I was really broken down and really desperate for help. And I actually answered him that no, I wasn't okay. And he helped me get free from my trafficker. We later married, and my trafficker stalked me for about 3 years, just trying to keep the pressure on, keep me from telling the story, which worked. I didn't tell until I went into therapy years later. And that's where I found out there was a name for what had happened to me, that it was sex trafficking. And I found out that my trafficker was in jail on a immigration and customs enforcement hold, and that he was potentially facing deportation. When I found that out, I just knew that I had to tell my story. So I contacted the prosecutor, and I was able to be a witness against him and told my story on 3 different occasions, every just awful detail. And he was eventually deported back to his home country of Peru. So I don't have to look over my shoulder anymore, which is amazing. Because I still think I see him, you know, now and then, it's still in my head. But then I get to remind myself that that's not him. He's not here. So that is how I broke free. And that's kind of where I'm at today.
That is so many complex feelings and emotions and things for you to go through in just a very short amount of time for our listeners. But I really commend you for coming out on the other side of this and being able to find your voice in really what amounts to a short amount of time, especially going through therapy that quickly as well. What are some of the things when you look back on that time period that you're like, oh, now I know that's a red flag, but I wouldn't have realized that at the time?
Oh gosh, there's so many. You know, looking back, they say hindsight's 20/20, and it so is. I look back and I'm like, was I the dumbest person on the planet? Like, what was wrong with me? Did I have victim like printed across my forehead and just red signs going off for the next perpetrator? But I didn't know it at the time. Yeah, I was so accustomed. My first treatment with my dad accustomed me to being mistreated and to be have my body used regardless of what I wanted. And so when my first husband came along, there were so many red flags. He would do these tests, like he would leave me at a park and tell me that if I really loved him, I would not talk to anybody and I would be there when he came back hours later to collect me. And just things like that, that, you know, a normal, healthy person, if they had that happen to them, would be like all up in arms and say, what are you doing? I'm not going along with this. But I was so used to the mistreatment that I just went along with it. And it was so obvious looking back, but at that moment it wasn't. And then with my trafficker, the grooming process now is pretty clear to me that he took really good care of me and fulfilled all my needs for about 2 weeks. And then that ended suddenly. And, you know, that's a huge red flag. That should have been a huge red flag to me. Even when he raped me, I said to myself, well, that was my fault because I'm in a relationship with him. I was never in a relationship with him. And I should never blame myself for that. But yeah, looking back, it's so clear. But at the moment, it just wasn't.
What were some of the things? I know now many things have changed in your life. What were some of the things that really helped you to kind of move forward and find your voice and begin to say, you know what? These things aren't normal. They are not okay. What happened to me was wrong. And I do want to share my story. What did that look like, that transition from thinking, oh, this is just the way that I'm treated, this is normal, to knowing better? Like, what did that process look like for you?
Well, it happened slowly over the course of many years in therapy. And that was really where my eyes were open. And it's like, oh, I don't have to be treated like this. And also, I married my current husband just a few years before going into therapy. And it was so wild. He would ask me what I wanted to watch on TV. And I'd be like, you care? Like, it matters what I think, you know? And so it was kind of a learning on the job training with him, where I just had such a different experience with him. And I was just blown away by the smallest things, like the TV or just him asking my opinion or wanting to know what I wanted for dinner or, you know, just all of those little things. And then, of course, in therapy, learning that kind of rebuilding myself is what it looked like. Rebuilding myself as far as who did I feel like I was? What did I believe? What did I think about things? What were my opinions? And I hadn't really taken time to consider that because I was always told what to think and told what to do. So it was a whole process. It took several years. I still feel like I'm in the middle of it, to be honest with you. I'm still in therapy and I'm still figuring it out every day.
I think it's so interesting because I think so many people who have either experienced some type of abuse as a child or abuse throughout their life, they get to this point where they go, oh, I have opinions, but what are they? Mm-hmm. I don't know what I like. What is my favorite color? What are my hobbies? So I think a lot of our listeners will definitely relate to what you said of having to kind of learn not only what your boundaries are and what you deserve, but who you even were, right? And what you even liked.
Did you ever see the movie Runaway Bride with Richard Gere and Julia Roberts?
Yeah, a long time ago.
Yeah. So there's this theme throughout where he's taking stock of all of the grooms that she left at the altar. And obviously, this is very different from your situation. But with each one, he asks how she liked her eggs best. And they were always the same as the grooms. And as you're talking about this, where you have to take on the other person's personality, because at the end, she's like, I love eggs Benedict. I hate all the other kinds of eggs. She sat down and had tried all of them to decide, this is what I actually like. Without anyone else's opinion, this is the one that I like. And how you were just describing that, I mean, that's the Hollywood glamorized, romanticized version, but it's kind of what it's like. You get out of these traumatic experiences and you have to sit down with all these plates of eggs and decide, did I actually like this or did I like it because I was fawning and it was easier to go along with what somebody else already liked or what I knew wouldn't get me in trouble? And how do I want to take my eggs? How do I like them best? And that just, for whatever reason, that's my brain at work, resonated with me because it is a process of sitting down and getting to know yourself again.
Yeah, I definitely feel like during my marriage, my first 5 years of marriage with my new husband, I was experiencing life for the first time in so many ways, you know, just figuring out what I liked and what I didn't like and who I wanted to be and who I didn't want to be and the people I wanted to be around and just everything. It was so much to take in, and it happened so fast. And I consider those the best years of my life, that I was really, really living because I was finally me. Like, I felt like I was me. I was an individual who had specific likes and needs and wants, and I was able to show those for the first time.
I feel like that happens too at a certain age, which is kind of a unique part of your story, is that this happened when you were an adult, right? And so I feel like at a certain age, you kind of have to figure out, what do I like? And it usually happens for most women in their 30s. And so it's like you had this natural progression of trying to figure out who you are anyway, which we all go through. And it coincided with these years of abuse and being told what to do, what to like. It's just very interesting to me how those things kind of overlapped. I'm just so excited that you had that opportunity to just relearn. And so now you have a lot of things you're passionate about, and you've learned that you care a lot about advocacy work, right? Tell us a little bit about what that looks like for you.
Yes. So I actually sought treatment out of state. I first went to Tennessee for a year, actually 13 months. And then I ended up in Boston, Massachusetts. And I stayed there for about 6 years, living on my own, receiving therapy away from my family and everything. And that was really challenging and really hard to go through. But I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to come back to Utah, my home state, because I just didn't know if I could be around all the triggers and see the places that I was taken and, you know, be in the same locations. And I just didn't know if that was going to work. And then my husband went to a work outing. It was a golf outing. And at one of the holes, it was sponsored by the Maloof Foundation. And he found out that, oh my gosh, they have a foundation that's fighting trafficking specifically. I mean, they fight all sorts of childhood exploitation and the exploitation of women. He let me know that there was this kind of this force to be reckoned with in Utah. And I really attribute them to me being able to come home, because without the support of them, without feeling like there was this army of people who cared and were looking into it and watching out for it and help protecting survivors, I just didn't feel like I could come home. So when I came home and I met with them, and they said, you can basically do anything you want to do with your story if you'd like to share it. And at first I was like, yeah, that's the last thing I want to do is share my story. But then I kind of realized really quickly that there was power in sharing my story, that I felt empowered by sharing it. And I loved, my favorite thing about it was that I wasn't keeping my traffickers, my other abusers, I wasn't keeping their secrets anymore. They weren't my secrets to keep. They were theirs, and I was going to tell them. And so that's been really powerful for me, really helpful.
That's so beautifully stated. They are not your secrets to keep. Their crimes are not our burdens to bear. And that goes for all offenders across the board. For survivors, you don't have to keep their secrets, and you don't have to carry that weight. So I want to talk about your book that recently came out. Where did this whole journey start? When did you start thinking about this? How are you approached? And when did it really take the form of being put into words on paper for you?
I met with the Maloof Foundation that I already talked about, and I told them my whole story, and it took me like 3 hours to tell them. They were so patient and so wonderful to sit and listen to that. It was my first time telling it outside of therapy, so I was like half in flashback while I was telling it. It was a mess, but they sat there and listened to it. And at the end, I said, what can I do with my story to make the biggest impact? And they said, we believe you should share your story. And so that's what started me talking about it. But then they said, have you ever thought of writing a book about your story? And I told them, I've definitely always wanted to write a book. Ever since I was a little kid, I had that desire to write a book, but I just never knew what it would be about. And so it was kind of like this, oh, that's what my book would be about. And not super sure that's the most exciting thing that I would want to write about. You know, like I was kind of planning on fiction, something happy. But yeah, it really soon just kind of struck me like, this is what I need to do. This is what I need to tell this story in its complete form. And so we decided to do it. And it's taken about four years to get it actually down on paper and through the editing process and the publishing process. And yeah, it's finally here. It's a weird people ask me, like, how does it feel to be a published author? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't really know. I'm excited on one hand and I am terrified on the other. And it feels a little bit vulnerable, which of course it is. And like exposing to know that just anybody could pick up my story and read the most intimate parts of my life. But on the other hand, that's exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to share it because I want to create awareness around all of these issues, child abuse, domestic violence, particularly sex trafficking, because I think that's so misunderstood and so little knowledge is out there about it. And so I feel really good having a purpose to all of my pain. All of that happened. I can't change that. I can't go back and change that as much as I'd like to. This is my story. It doesn't define me, but I want to use it as a tool. I want to have a purpose for it. My book really gave me that sense of purpose, and thinking that somebody could read it and draw inspiration from it, or if they're going through a bad time, you know, they can see that I survived and maybe they can get through it as well, or to even better prevent sex trafficking or any of these abuses from happening would be just amazing. So I feel really lucky that I was able to write it, and as scary as it is, I'm really proud of it and really excited that I hope it will do its job out there and educate people.
Yeah. It sounds like you're saying it was freeing in many, many ways for you.
Yeah, definitely. I felt like I finally unloaded all of that trauma out of my brain and put it somewhere else. And that was just such a freeing experience.
We are so thankful for all of your support. We're also supported by Cured. They are a supplement company that is changing the industry standard for how supplements are made. They are products that I use every day that have genuinely changed my life.
Kara, of course, is the one who introduced me to them, and I was a little hesitant at first, but I can say after using their products for the last couple of months, I'm hooked.
My favorites that I think everyone should try and will love are the Serenity, Zen, and Rise. Serenity gummies have ashwagandha, L-theanine, and CBD. They're going to help you to just relax, take the edge off at the end of a long day or whenever you need it. Zen is going to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, and sleep soundly. Hallelujah. And Rise is going to give you sustained energy and focus without caffeine or without a crash.
I was really hesitant to try anything I view as a sleep aid, but I can say after incorporating Zen into my nighttime routine, I am getting such better sleep.
Yes. And for all of our listeners, you can use code KARA10, go to curednutrition.com or go to the link in our show notes to take you straight to the website. We hope that you love it as much as we do.
One of the things that you kind of mentioned when you were talking about your book is helping people to understand trafficking. And I think right now it's especially important. We have this movie, this gigantic movie that's just come out, The Sound of Freedom. And I think when most people think of trafficking, they think of people being snatched up in parking lots. They think of the movie Taken. They think of people being taken from other countries. They don't think of domestic trafficking and relational trafficking, which is, I would say, the vast majority of what we see in the United States is that form of trafficking. They don't think of that. So would you like to speak to the realities of what trafficking looks like? Any statistics specifically that you have, anything like that? Because I always find this to be an interesting conversation because I don't know about you guys, but people ask me all the time. I'm extremely interested in trying to help people who have been trafficked. And they're like, so I need to go to other countries. What do I need to do? And I'm like, you need to start here because people don't think about what it looks like here. So we would love to hear more information from you and your work with Maalouf of what trafficking actually looks like.
Yeah. So the biggest thing I want to say, and I feel like just screaming it, this is happening right now. At this very moment, there are women and children being trafficked right now in our own country, happening in our own neighborhoods. So many people think that, like you said, that it's a kidnapping and you're taken off the street and then taken to this kind of dark side of town where nobody sees what's happening. That's not true. I was living in a nice suburban area. I was trafficked right from my home and in areas near my home. Actually, so he moved me to an apartment in a local neighborhood, and I was trafficked there in the apartment. He brought men there to the apartment. And these are nice places. These are places I've lived my whole life. I've grown up there. Not what you would think as far as where trafficking would happen, but that's exactly where it's happening. It's happening right in front of us. It's happening in our neighborhoods, in our backyards. This could be your neighbor next door. This could be the PTA president. This could be anybody. I was shocked when I was trafficked. I was shocked how invisible I felt. I was right there in the community in which I was raised and grew up in, and I was having this horrible thing done to me. It's in plain sight, but also in the shadows. I mean, I was in plain sight in the fact that I went to gas stations, I went to restaurants with him, we went to stores, we went to the mall, we went to places like that where he would buy me outfits and the things that I needed, and he used so many threats against me that I didn't dare say anything to anybody. So there was one time where my trafficker actually took me to a police station, and I was in the police station with him while he was talking to an officer. And I thought to myself, this is crazy. Like this is insane. I'm standing right here. I'm this victim of a crime. I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was serious. And I don't dare say anything because he threatened to hurt my children. And I just could not risk that. Among other things, he took photos and videos of my abuse and threatened to send that out to my community. And I just, there were so many barriers for me to feel like I could ask for help. But yeah, I was right there in my community. The places he took me were nice neighborhoods, nice hotels. I mean, sometimes they were terrible hotels and motels, but sometimes they were nice. Sometimes they were nice neighborhoods that we snuck in the back door and it was a brothel inside. And I just think people don't realize, and I don't blame them because I didn't realize it either until it happened to me, but it's happening right here. Like you said, most victims know their trafficker. I knew mine. He was a father of one of my preschool students. I knew him for about 8 months before he ended up trafficking me. This is happening with people that we know. 40% of trafficking is familial. The families are trafficking their children. And I mean, that's just mind-blowing and just horrific. So yeah, there's so much I want people to know. If you go to themalooffoundation.org, there's so much you can learn. Specifically, I'd like to just mention the I Am On Watch initiative that the Maloof Foundation has. It's a 1-hour training. It's totally free. It's module-based, so you could watch like one or two modules, take a break, and come back for the rest of them. I think there's 14 total. It's a training that's made by survivors, and so every module is a different survivor story of his or her actual trafficking experience, what happened to them. And then at the end, they kind of do this really cool wrap up with a professional saying, these are the signs you could have looked for. These are things you could have seen. This is where someone could have intervened in this story to make this end sooner for this poor victim. And so it's really powerful, a really powerful training that you can learn what trafficking looks like here in the United States. Again, that's IamOnWatch.org.
Well, and as you were just saying this about the intervening, is there anything that you think back and you're like, I wish someone would have asked or said or done that could have helped me? Because when I look back at different times in my life, I'm like, oh, someone could have said these words to me that may have helped, you know, a year or two down the road. But at that moment, I wouldn't have listened to them, or I wouldn't have felt safe enough to respond in a way that could have got me help. Is there anything that when you think back on that, you wish somebody could have done for you?
Yeah, there's so many. So my trafficker was a long-haul truck driver. So he was driving a semi-rig with a trailer. We were going through Montana, actually, and he had me come sit in the front seat. He usually relegated me to the back bed where he would close the curtain and I just have to stay hidden. But he had me come sit in the front seat, and he was just being, I don't even remember exactly what he was saying, but I just remember that it was awful things that he was saying and accusing me of. And he was like slapping me and hitting me into the door. and I just kind of snapped and had enough. And I opened the door to the moving vehicle and jumped out. And there was snow, luckily, to catch my fall, because I don't know, I might have been hurt otherwise. And then I took off running into the woods and really quickly realized that the snow was too deep. I wouldn't be able to go that direction. So I got back to the main road and started running down the road. A car coming the opposite direction, I was waving my arms frantically. I was trying to get them to stop to help me. I wasn't really thinking clearly. I was just kind of in panic mode. So I don't know, I might have just hopped in the car with them or just asked them for help. But I was waving my arms at them and they slowed down. And right about the time they slowed down near me, my trafficker caught up with me and just tackled me to the ground and started pulling me by my hair back to his vehicle. The other car ended up just driving off. And I think about them all the time. I don't have hard feelings because I know it was a scary situation and I don't know what I would have done. So I'm not judging them, because I think that would have been a really scary thing. And if they don't know what to do, they just don't know what to do. But had they had any sort of training or any information about it, they may not have known it was trafficking, but they could obviously see it was a dangerous situation. They could have called the National Trafficking Hotline or just the police. And yeah, I think about those. There were many of those instances where somebody saw, kind of hesitated, and then didn't act. And had they done that, I mean, I could have been rescued sooner. I could have got out. I wouldn't have had such a long experience with it. So definitely, that's why I think it's so important that we create awareness. And that's with my book. I just really, really want people to be aware that it's happening and kind of what it looks like with the IamOnWatch.org, and so that they can see those signs and make a phone call. You don't have to be right. It could be wrong. Nothing's going to happen negatively to you if you make a report and it doesn't end up being trafficking, but at least you made the report in case.
Yes. I read your interview with Maloof that you did for like the press release and everything that coincided with your book. And one of the things that I had not heard about your story was this time that you were in a Home Depot and you ran to the bathroom. And then later someone asked, well, why didn't you ask for help from one of the employees? And I think this is something that many victims at some point experience, is this, well, why didn't you? Why didn't you do this? And I think it ties in so well to these other experiences you had where someone saw you getting dragged by the hair backwards, right, towards a vehicle and didn't help. I would love for you to share like that little piece and what that felt like and overcoming that, because I think it's so important with the title of your book, which is Shadowed, and how you felt invisible, and it all kind of goes together.
Yeah, it was actually the time that you're mentioning with the Home Depot. I was actually testifying against my trafficker when I told that story, that part of the story. And it was the judge who stopped me kind of mid-sentence and said, why didn't you ask the people working in Home Depot for help? And I was like, oh, wow. I don't know exactly how to let you know how scared I was. Like, I don't know how to tell you why I didn't ask for help. It was, I was mentally chained to my trafficker. I was so terrified. There were so
it's
many.
It's not that simple.
No.
And a judge. Oh, right. In the courtroom when a victim is on trial, like, oh my God.
Just not to get super soapboxy here, folks, but judges do not always have to go through victim training. They don't always understand the dynamics of victimization. They're there to read the law and interpret it. And for us to have to explain to a sitting judge why this is important and why we acted the way that we did is something that we can impact. And you can clear the bench. You can take judges out of their positions of power. That is something that you can look into and do in your communities, but it shouldn't always be on us to be the Google for other survivors or people that are looking to vote. You can always look at Clear the Bench. I think it's clearthebenchcolorado.org. I'm going to find out and we can include in show notes if there's something similar in other states, but it gives you information on the different judges and how they've ruled some of the different things coming out, especially right now, are with gross miscarriages of justice that judges intervene. And I mean, asking a victim that question in any scenario, just I'm flabbergasted. And I can't believe that you had to answer that, especially in a courtroom. But I'm so sorry that you had to go through that. Judges are not always the most educated on victimization and what survivors go through.
Yeah, I didn't know how to respond. I'm like, because he threatened to kill me, like he threatened to kill my children. Of course, I'm not going to say anything to risk that. Like, no, I wasn't going to say anything. And so I locked myself in the bathroom only to realize I had just trapped myself. And he came and he ended up pulling me out anyway and taking me back to the truck. But yeah, I've had that question quite a bit. You were at the police station. Why didn't you just scream and say, this guy's trafficking me? First of all, I didn't know he was trafficking me. Second of all, he told me I'd be in as much trouble as he was. Like, he's fed me all these lies about it. So I didn't understand anything about it. I had only his opinion to take on it. And he told me that I was as guilty as he was. I believed him. I didn't want my children taken away from me. I was in a nasty custody battle. I was not willing to risk anything to lose my kids. So yeah, it's a hard question to hear because there's judgment with it, of course, you know, like, well, why didn't you just do this? And it's just not that simple.
But it's something that many victims get at some point in sharing their story. And I try to give humanity, people in general, the benefit of the doubt when they ask these questions because they are trying to understand, because people think they know how they would act in a situation, right? So I'm kidnapped out of my friend's front yard and people say, well, why did you say her parents weren't there? Like, they're trying to understand, why did you do that? And it's this fine line between trying to understand and victim blaming. Because, I mean, I keep going back to this, like, we're not your Google. This is something that our last episode, our guest said, is like, the survivors in your life are not Google about survivors. Like, they're not the person that you need to go to try to understand these things. If you're having trouble understanding why victims blank, why did a victim of a crime do blank? Do your own research. Don't ask the victims, because it feels to us like you are blaming us for what happened. And that's not fair, because it's never your fault that someone decides to do something awful to you.
Yeah, I definitely felt like, oh, I didn't realize I had failed so badly. You know, why didn't I ask for help? But of course, I just didn't know how to put it into words. I just didn't feel that was an option. That's just how it is. I did not feel that was an option.
And you did everything correctly, because you're still with us here today.
Yeah.
You know what you need to do to survive in those scenarios better than anyone else ever will. And for anyone to question you after the fact is making you question yourself and your own survival instincts. But the fact that you're still here means you did it right.
Yeah, everything I did was to survive. I had one choice to make every day, and that was, do I survive this or do I not? And it was always a choice to survive. So I did things that I'm not proud of. I did things I would never do in my normal life. I did things that were against the law. And of course, I never chose to do any of that. I chose to survive.
So tell us a little bit about what you are up to now.
Well, so I have my book, and then I've been doing a few book releases, and that's been fun. I'm still available whenever Maloof needs me to speak at different functions. I'm willing to speak and share my story. I'm kind of just waiting to see where this whole thing takes me. I'm trying to rebuild my life as I go. I'm about halfway. They tell me about halfway through therapy, whatever that really means. I don't know, because I kind of feel like therapy is something I'll be in for the rest of my life. And I'm okay with that. Like, that's okay with me. So yeah, I'm just rediscovering life on this side of it. You know, it was a rediscovery when I first got out of my trafficking situation and escaped all those years of abuse. And then I went back through therapy, and that kind of was a new benchmark that I feel like now I'm figuring out who I am after therapy. So there's just a lot of figuring out.
Okay, so we always like to end our episodes by giving our followers a call to action, a way to follow along with what you're doing, a way to follow along with things that matter to you. So we would love for you to tell us what would be a call to action or something that you would love our listeners to follow along with.
I think the number one thing that I would ask, and I feel like I would beg your listeners to do this, I would beg everybody to do this, is to go take the IamOnWatch.org training, because you can't know what you're looking for until you know. Like, you can't see something if you don't know what you're looking for. If you can take the training and see what trafficking really looks like and what the signs are, what the red flags are, what to see, what to do, what actions to take, it really goes through everything. That would be really great. And then of course, I'm just going to throw it out there. Like, if you can read my book, that would be another way to know what trafficking really, really looked like, how it all came about, how it happens to those of us who are vulnerable, and how I got through it and how I escaped.
And I think that for anyone who wants to follow along with information about your book or wants to contact you, correct me if I'm wrong, but reaching out to Maloof would be the best way to do that, right?
Yeah, definitely. I received a lot of information from Maloof, and you can just go to malooffoundation.org and reach out to them there.
Well, thank you so much for being willing to share today, Julie. It was really a pleasure being able to hear the incredible work that you've done since overcoming this unthinkable tragedy. And I just really commend you on all of the work that you've put in to sharing your story for the benefit of others.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I respect both of you. I think you're both amazing women and such good role models and activists in everything that you do. And I just really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
The pleasure is all ours. Thank you.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain.
If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show.
To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.